Welcome back to VOA Special Inauguration Day coverage. Along with Joe DiCapua, I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up in this next hour, we'll discuss the main problems and priorities for the new Obama administration, and we'll experience the popular celebration of the new president as the traditional inaugural parade makes its way from Capitol Hill up Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. We have reporters along the parade route who will describe the celebration and talk with other Americans who have braved the cold temperatures here in Washington to be a part of this inaugural event.
But first, some more difficult matters, the challenges facing Barack Obama.
The state of our economy calls for action, bold and swift, and we will act, not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. We will build the roads and bridges, the electric grids and digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. We will restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its cost. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories. And we will transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age. All this we can do. All this we will do. Now, there are some who question the scale of our ambitions, who suggest that our system cannot tolerate too many big plans. Their memories are short, for they have forgotten what this country has already done, what free men and women can achieve when imagination is joined to common purpose and necessity to courage. What the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted beneath them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works, whether it helps families find jobs at a decent wage, care they can afford, a retirement that is dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, programs will end. And those of us who manage the public's dollars will be held to account to spend wisely, reform bad habits, and do our business in the light of day, because only then can we restore the vital trust between a people and their government.
Joining us to discuss the problems facing Barack Obama and his new job and how he'll go about setting his priorities is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, Jim, you have a world in financial turmoil. You have two wars going. You have political debts Mr. Obama must attend to, and untold challenges that will likely land on his desk very soon. So where does he begin?
Well, he begins by watching about a four-hour parade and going to 10 inaugural balls. How's that? Actually, he gets a day to rest up. He gets a day to celebrate and enjoy. But yes, the hard work begins immediately. And there's no question, Joe, that the domestic economy is going to dominate the next several weeks of his administration. He basically won the election because people were fed up with the way the economy was going. They wanted a change. He promised change. He promised to have some of the answers. And we're going to see now whether or not that's true. And, of course, the first thing he's going to have to do is get his Democratic colleagues in Congress to pass this huge stimulus bill. More than $800 billion of government spending. A lot of Republicans think that's too much. Some may support it, but many may oppose it. But again, he's got Democrats controlling both chambers of the Congress. So the public is going to expect to get this program passed relatively soon, and we'll see how long they will wait for results in terms of actually turning around the economy. But that's got to be his focus. And yet, as I say that, look what's happening in Afghanistan. Some terrible issues in terms of security there, and of course the continuing challenges in Iraq, and of course the Middle East, where people have already been calling on President Obama to speak out about the violence there. So foreign policy is not going to let up, and unlike the transition where he only focused on the economy, he now is going to have to address each and every one of these daunting foreign policy issues as well.
How long do you think the American public will give Mr. Obama before they start getting a little restless, saying, why isn't the economy getting better?
The polls indicate people will be patient. They have a lot of confidence in him. Some of the polls have indicated a majority of Americans believe that the economy may even get worse or not rebound for a year or two. They seem, at this point, willing to put up with that. I think what the new president has to do, obviously, is be seen to be working on their behalf. He needs to be cooperative, especially with the Democrats running Congress. But where he can, reach out to Republicans, because people do want to see a more bipartisan approach, especially on the economy. So he will have some time there. But, you know, the other unknown here is, what about, say, foreign policy distractions, a new conflict somewhere, a ratcheting up of the tensions in the Middle East? We don't know what's going to occupy his time in the months ahead, but he certainly has to focus on the economy for domestic political consumption.
Thank you, Jim. That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Well, we've heard what some of the experts have to say about the problems to be faced by the Obama administration, but what does the rest of the world have to say about them? We pose that question to some of our correspondents around the world. We start with correspondent Luis Ramirez from our bureau in Jerusalem.
Barack Obama said he will take on the Middle East peace process on day one. With Israel's offensive on Gaza and hundreds dead, the crisis has escalated. This Palestinian hopes Mr. Obama will be sympathetic to Palestinians. He appeals to Mr. Obama to stop all wars all over the world. Israelis hope the United States remains a strong ally.
I hope that the American president will be strong and not crumble under the pressure of terrorism and the crumble under the pressure of anti-Israel sentiments.
Elsewhere in the Middle East, Inauguration Day is seen as a new chance for better relations with Washington. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said he does not want to judge Mr. Obama ahead of time and will wait to see what his administration will do. In Iraq, people count on Mr. Obama to draw down U.S. forces while fulfilling America's promises of democracy and lasting stability. I'm Luis Ramirez in Jerusalem.
For the first time, a giant television screen was installed in Nairobi's main convention center to broadcast the U.S. presidential inauguration ceremony. In publicizing the event, a local television network, KTN, invited the public to watch, in KTN's words, "our son make American history." Mr. Obama's father, Barack Obama Sr., hails from Western Kenya, giving Kenyans a special connection with the new president. 39-year-old Nairobi resident Elphas Chazara says he is still amazed at the thought that someone with Kenyan roots will be residing at the White House.
We'll be proud because one of us become a president in America.
Mr. Obama has visited Kenya several times. The last visit was in 2006 when he toured the country as a U.S. senator. He spoke about improving education, strengthening democracy, and eliminating poverty and corruption as important steps toward improving the lives of Kenyans. The people here say they have high hopes that these issues will now be a part of President Obama's development agenda for the country. Alicia Ruvioi, News, Nairobi.
Many ordinary Russians have been impressed by Mr. Obama. A journalism student in Moscow named Nastya told VOA that Mr. Obama strikes her as a great speaker. She says his inauguration holds promise for improved U.S.-Russian relations, following what she says was a period of neglect under President George Bush. Like many Russians, Nastya is impressed that an African-American is moving into the White House. Nastya notes that less than a century ago, many people still considered blacks to be slaves, and there were even park benches for whites only in America. But, she says, in the course of 100 years, there is a black U.S. president. She says many Russians were shocked and surprised by Mr. Obama's election. According to the polls, about 30% of Russians did not pay attention to the U.S. election. Lyudmila Ivanovna, a retiree in Moscow, is among them because she is disenchanted with politics in her own country. She wonders how Dmitry Medvedev came to be president and considers Kremlin politics to be a riddle. Lyudmila Ivanovna notes that the U.S. and Russian presidents should think more about their own people and not about ways of doing something bad to others. Political analyst Andrei Kortunov, president of the Eurasia Foundation in Moscow, says the Obama inauguration is important not only because of its significance for U.S. race relations.
Политик нового поколения, это политик уже 21-го,
Kortunov says the inauguration heralds the arrival of a politician from a new generation, a 21st century politician. He notes that much is expected of the new president because the United States is on the brink of crisis and faces many problems which unfortunately have not been addressed. So he says the inauguration represents hope that America will, in the end, be able to solve those problems. Kortunov says Mr. Obama would do well to downplay the high expectations being placed on him to avoid disenchantment later. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin expressed a similar view Saturday in an interview with German newspaper editors in Dresden. Mr. Putin said his deepest belief is that bitter disappointments usually result from excessive expectations. Mr. Putin says we need to see what happens in practice. Peter Fedinsky, VOA News, Moscow.
While there is anxiety about some of the new president's campaign pledges, such as halting the proliferation of nuclear weapons and reducing the outsourcing of American jobs, in general, Indians seem hopeful the relationship with the United States will improve as it did for the past 16 years under the Clinton and Bush administrations. Former Indian Foreign Secretary and Ambassador to the United States, Lalit Mansingh, tells VOA that Mr. Obama's pledge of multilateralism is especially encouraging.
We do hope that he will reach out to countries, and we hope that he will include India in finding solutions to global problems.
Political analysts say they expect the Obama White House to back away from campaign rhetoric that tied solving regional terrorism stemming from elements in Pakistan and Afghanistan to the Kashmir issue. There is also a sense of relief that then-Senator Obama was a strong supporter of the India-U.S. civil nuclear agreement, a major accomplishment for both President Bush and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. If the Senate approves the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, something the Obama White House is expected to strongly push, former Ambassador Mansingh says Beijing and New Delhi are likely to face U.S. pressure to act in kind.
People are a bit anxious about what he's going to do, how much pressure he's going to put on India to sign the CTBT. Mind you, this is not something new. We had faced pressure from the Clinton administration to sign the CTBT.
Another former foreign secretary, Shyam Saran, now a special envoy for the prime minister, tells VOA News there is relief the new president has chosen a familiar face, Hillary Clinton, as his secretary of state.
Having someone in that influential position who has a certain knowledge and I would say even a certain sympathy for India, this can only be a plus point.
In the Senate, Hillary Clinton served as co-chair of the India caucus and preceded her husband, then-President Bill Clinton, in visiting India. The president-elect recently pledged to Prime Minister Singh to work together on major global issues, giving rise to expectations the relationship between India and the United States will reach unprecedented heights in the years ahead. Steve Herman, VOA News, New Delhi.
Well, some would say there's no more pressing concern for Barack Obama than security. And the fight against world terrorism is primary among security concerns. During his campaign for office, Mr. Obama promised that as one of his first acts as president, he would order the closure of the U.S. Military Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, a prison that has been a primary focus of those challenging the Bush administration's record on human rights. Now, Mr. Obama is said to have softened his position on Guantanamo, saying immediate closure of the facility would be a challenge. Simon Koschut, with the German Council on Foreign Relations, will soon publish an article on the implications of the closure of Guantanamo. He joins us from Berlin. Mr. Koschut, how important is it to the international community that Barack Obama shut down Guantanamo?
Guantanamo Bay is a symbol of the Bush administration's failure in the war on terror and the failure of standing up to American values and Western values in kind. And so it would be a highly symbolic step to close this camp as soon as possible and also sort of show that it's not only words but also deeds in Obama's policies.
So how does the Obama vision of terrorism differ from that of the Bush administration?
Actually, not as much as we would guess. I mean, he still calls it the war on terror, and he will still defend America and go further than we would go in the fight against terror here in Europe and especially in Germany. But there's a big but, because he will just cut down on the extensions that the war on terror has brought. You know, with the problematic things about spying on citizens, as well as detention camps, rendition programs, etc.
Now, you talk about those various programs that came into being during the Bush administration. If those various programs are eliminated during an Obama administration, do you think it would hurt the U.S. war on terrorism?
I think it would, and Americans will, and the Obama administration will think so as well. I actually do not expect that they will shut down some of the programs, especially not the rendition program, which was actually introduced by the Clinton administration, but extended in quality and respect by the Bush administration. Now, what Obama will do, and what some of his advisors have already said he will do, is he will leave the rendition program as a valuable tool in the war on terror, but he will leave it within constitutional lines, so as that there will be no misunderstanding about torture and things like that.
So is it simply a matter of image that the Obama administration is trying to change?
Not necessarily all image. Image is a big part in that, but image has to be followed by concrete actions. So he will just sort of try to eliminate the problematic and just illegal and intransparent things that happened during the war on terror. But the war on terror will go on, and he has said that he will forge an alliance for the 21st century to fight terrorism, and also has said, which actually goes a bit farther than the Bush administration, that he will, you know, even unilaterally attack Pakistan if that is necessary.
Thank you, sir. That's Simon Koschut. He's with the German Council on Foreign Relations, and he spoke with us from Berlin.
Well, among those observing today's inauguration was Kenyan-born historian and author Ali Mazrui. Professor Mazrui teaches political science and African studies at the State University of New York at Binghamton. Our colleague Ashanafi Abeji asked him, as someone of Kenyan heritage like Barack Obama, how he views today's historic event.
Oh, I'm very deeply moved as a Kenyan, as an African, and indeed as a human being, because it's a major step forward in human relations. We have been anticipating it in Kenya in different ways, with articles and with poetry and with songs, and now it's here, and we salute the event.
Now we'll get to the African support element in just a moment, but the newly inaugurated president enjoys the support of a cross-section of the American public, racial groups, political groups, and religious persuasions. Does this tell us more about President Obama himself or about the evolving American electorate?
It needed both of those, because the mood of the American electorate had reached a stage when it was ready to deal with multiracialism, even with a kind of post-racialism. But it has taken a special kind of leader to make that mood translated into political behavior and into aspirations for fundamental reforms in society. So the United States has changed for certain, and it got a leader suitable for the moment.
Now, as you briefly alluded to earlier, Professor Mazrui, Africans here in the U.S., and on the continent itself are quite thrilled about Mr. Obama's becoming president. And yet some say there may be unrealistic expectations by Africans from an Obama presidency. You agree?
Absolutely. There is a tremendous hope and expectation that relations between the United States and Africa would be dramatically changed, and indeed that world politics would be fundamentally altered. And I'd like to believe that there will indeed be some change. Africa has been celebrating from quite early. I was lecturing in South Africa way back in September, and they already had shirts saying South Africans for Obama, T-shirts. And that's in South Africa. And in Kenya, you can imagine the enthusiasm. In general, we should not expect something superhuman. It was a miracle that he became president of the United States. There may be one or two other miracles, but we shouldn't expect too many.
So when all is said and done, what can Africans, especially African leaders, what can they learn from Mr. Obama's election and his presidency?
We need to pay special attention to his emphasis on bringing people together across races, across ethnicity in Africa, so-called tribe, and indeed across generations, the young and the old. And Africa is way behind on issues of rotation of ethnic groups in ultimate power. We therefore should also learn from Americans that they have at last permitted a black person to assume the presidency. There are many ethnic groups in Africa which are denied entry to ultimate power. We should open the gates to fair treatment in politics and in society.
Professor Ali Mazrui spoke with VOA's Ashanafi Abeje.
Inauguration 2009, live on The Voice of America.
Eddie Cross is the policy coordinator for the opposition movement for democratic change in Zimbabwe. He joins us from Harare. Mr. Cross, do you believe that the policies of the new Barack Obama administration will differ significantly from that of President Bush in dealing with the ongoing political crisis in Zimbabwe?
I definitely think there will be a huge difference with the new president, substantial increase in terms of development assistance, but it's not only the amount of money that will matter, but also the direction of development assistance.
What direction do you think it will take?
Well, what we have seen in the last 8 years under Bush was that much of the development assistance was put under an ideological perspective. For example, in countries where HIV epidemics are driven largely by injecting drug use, there was a reluctance to fund necessary harm reduction interventions to provide, for example, sterile needles. And I think that will almost certainly change under the new president.
What programs would you like to see put forth by an Obama administration regarding global health?
We apologize. We had some technical difficulties there. That was not Eddie Cross. Eddie Cross hopefully will join us now. He is the policy coordinator for the opposition movement for democratic change, and he's joining us from Harare. Mr. Cross, do you believe the policies of the new Obama administration will differ significantly from that of President Bush in dealing with the ongoing political crisis in Zimbabwe? Hello, Mr. Cross?
I don't think the policies will... Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Right. I don't think the policies will vary very much, but I think what will vary is the quality of their application and the consistency of the basic philosophy behind those policies. And I think, for example, his speech this afternoon at the inauguration very clearly enunciated how he's going to deal with tyrannical regimes like Zimbabwe is under at this point in time, and that's very encouraging to us.
In the past, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has often accused the United States and Britain of racism and colonialism. Do you think that having a president now who is of African ancestry, that will make a difference in that regard in dealing with Mr. Mugabe?
I think it'll make a huge difference, although Mr. Mugabe has already made a number of derogatory remarks about Mr. Obama. I think he's going to find himself, as President Obama said, on the wrong side of history. And I'm sure that he's going to find it much more difficult to deal with pressure from the United States than he has in the past.
Your country has suffered so much recently. What has been the reaction in Zimbabwe to this new incoming Obama administration?
Oh, gosh. Difficult to imagine. My wife watched the inauguration a couple of hours ago and was very emotional about it and just wished that we in Zimbabwe could see a transition of power here, just as you've seen in the United States. MDC, of course, won the election in March, but we haven't seen a transfer of power. Kenya went through the same agony. Africa has got a long way to go before it really accepts the reality of democratic transitions, but hopefully the Obama experience will encourage it in Africa as well.
All right, thank you very much. That is Eddie Cross. He is the policy coordinator for the opposition MDC in Zimbabwe, and he spoke to us from Harare.
One of the most challenging issues facing world leaders today is promoting religious tolerance. It is a key factor that comes into play in such problems as world terrorism, racial strife, and even economic inequity. Mustafa Akyol is a columnist for the Daily News of Turkey. He has given seminars in several universities in the U.S. and the U.K. on issues of faith, science, religious tolerance, or interfaith dialogue. He joins us now, and sir, how would you counsel Mr. Obama to ease tensions and strife among various religious groups?
Well, first I should say I was deeply impressed by the speech, inauguration speech of President Obama. I would just counsel him to stand by the principles that he has declared in this speech and beforehand in his campaign. Many people in my country, in Turkey, for example, are expecting a lot of things, a lot of foreign policy changes in Obama. Because in the past 8 years, there has been several conflicts in the Middle East, like the Iraq War, and right now the ongoing conflict among the Palestinians and Israelis, the recent Israeli attack on Gaza. And all these things create a lot of impact on all these Middle Eastern nations. And people, generally, the populations here in my country were not a fan of the Iraqi war. We thought it was an unnecessary war, and Obama said the same thing, and he would end this war, and he would pull back from Iraq. That's a thing that, you know, may make the Turkish people more optimistic about the U.S., and also the ongoing conflict in Israel, that is also a crucial problem. And the more innocent people die in Gaza, the less people have a positive attitude towards Israel or the United States. So these conflicts should definitely be solved through dialogue. And for dialogue, you have to talk with some of the people maybe that you see as terrorists.
Can you really separate religion from these conflicts?
You cannot, but religion has different interpretations, and the reason why the radical interpretation sometimes gets more popular than the moderate interpretation is the political context. What happens on the ground affects people, and if they are in a political, if they're in a military conflict, if they are, like, bombs are falling on their heads, they tend to listen to the people who have the more radical views because it's a radicalizing context. So yes, definitely understanding between religions is very important. And that's why, you know, Muslims, Jews, Christians, and all other faiths, and Hindus in, you know, Pakistan, they should, or India, they should definitely engage in interfaith dialogue. But we should also try to solve the conflicts, which act as engines of radicalization, as engines of hatred, engines of feelings of revenge.
Thank you, sir. That's Mustafa Akyol, a columnist for the Daily News of Turkey.
The election of President Obama set off a debate in East and Southern Asia about the political power of ethnic minorities in such countries as Singapore and India. C. Raja Mohan is a professor of South Asian Studies at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. He describes the reaction there to America's new president.
No, as everywhere else, there's been extraordinarily positive reaction to Obama here, especially in Indonesia, where he was raised, and there is a great enthusiasm throughout his campaign. There was, in the ruling classes, you might say, in the region, I mean, there was always some concern about Democrats and how they'll deal with the trade issues. Would they tend to be more protectionist? Those concerns do exist. That's a general concern about the Democratic Party. But in relation to Obama specifically, and I think it's a fairy tale, everyone has followed it here, and I think it's a fantastic expectations do exist today across the region, irrespective of race, ethnicity, etc.
Are there areas in Southeast Asia where the election of Senator Obama to the presidency has given hope to groups that have been traditionally repressed or downtrodden?
I don't think in Singapore you can say there is any racial oppression. It is a multicultural society. But yet, I think the election of Obama did generate a debate here. Would a non-Chinese would ever become the Prime Minister of Singapore? The question whether there can be someone from the minority like the Indians or the Malays can ever become the Prime Minister, that's a question Singapore has debated publicly since Obama's election. And I think this is something the region will indeed debate in the coming months and years. How would these countries react to Someone who's become a citizen, merely, say, a family that's become a citizen in its second generation, and how the political classes would react. And I think it has raised these issues. And I think this is something the region will indeed debate in the coming months and years.
You had mentioned in some of your writings that in India, some classes and some minority groups have felt empowered by the election of President Obama, and one being the Dalits. Can you tell me just a bit about that?
In India, there was a lot of comparison between a Dalit leader in India, that is the so-called scheduled caste, I mean, who've been oppressed for centuries. Her name is Mayawati, and she recently became the chief minister of India's largest state. So there's been a lot of comparison between her career and that of Obama. And the prospect that, and there is a good shot, she will be quite a powerful player in the next general election. So there is a debate in India, whether the Dalits have progressed fully, whether they're fully politically empowered, and what are the prospects that India might have a Dalit as the prime minister of the country.
Okay, that is C. Raja Mohan is a professor of South Asian Studies at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, and he was speaking with VOA's William Eagle.
Well, health issues are among the prominent concerns of Africa and other regions of the world faced by economic hardship and technological challenges. And the election of Barack Obama could have implications for global health programs. So says a recent editorial in the British Medical Journal. It calls on Mr. Obama to set the tone for health care within his first 100 days in office. Dr. Bernd Rachel is co-author of that editorial. He is also a lecturer at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
I definitely think there will be a huge difference with the new president, substantial increase in terms of development assistance, but it's not only the amount of money that will matter, but also the direction of development assistance.
What direction do you think it will take?
Well, what we have seen in the last 8 years under Bush was that much of the development assistance was put under an ideological perspective. For example, in countries where HIV epidemics are driven largely by injecting drug use, there was a reluctance to fund necessary harm reduction interventions to provide, for example, sterile needles. And I think that will almost certainly change under the new president.
What programs would you like to see put forth by an Obama administration regarding global health?
I would expect to have more pronounced support of the relevant initiatives under the UN, such as Millennium Development Goals, but also the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria. These are vertical programs, mainly directed at infectious diseases. What we would also hope for is a greater support for health system strengthening initiatives.
Do you foresee any greater cooperation with other countries with the United States?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the United States is not only the most important bilateral donor in the health sector, but it's also a very important driver of research in the health arena. And we would, of course, then expect a greater collaboration as well in terms of finding out what actually works internationally in terms of development assistance and what doesn't.
Do you fear that the economic slowdown might affect the global health programs?
Yes, of course. I mean, it is too early to say whether it will be possible to live up to the quite ambitious promises in the election campaign to scale up the amount of development assistance. But as I said earlier, I don't think it's the amount is the only thing that matters, but it's also important direction of funding.
If you had to set priorities for an Obama administration regarding global health, what would you say?
There are some issues that will have an effect on global health which have nothing to do with development assistance, and one of the most important is climate change and how this is being approached. And there we are very hopeful that the Obama administration will tackle this issue much more aggressively than the previous administration. And this will, in a global sense, a global health sense, probably be the most important issue. This, I think, has been very well documented already, that climate change will have a huge effect on human health.
That's Dr. Bernd Rachel. He's a lecturer at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
Well, across the Atlantic in London, members of an organization called Operation Black Vote celebrated the Obama inauguration today with a large public rally that included a number of black politicians running for office in Britain. Ashok Viswanathan is the founder of Operation Black Vote and a coordinator of today's event. He joins us now from London. Mr. Viswanathan, describe for us what you've got going on today and why you put this rally together.
Hi, guys. Why we put this together is, initially, it's about sentimentality. I mean, what we're seeing, what we're witnessing in the U.S. is unprecedented, and it's inspiring for us Brits, and we want to use it not just to celebrate the high watermark that's been set in the U.S., but to focus minds here in the U.K. that it's not just about Obama. As Obama said, this is not about me. This is about you. It's about getting people to play a full and positive role in the democratic and decision-making process. And we want people here in the U.K., young people, black and white, to play a full and positive role in the democratic and decision-making process. We want them around the decision-making table, not just as presidents, but also in all areas, at all levels, as school governors, as magistrates, as people that are willing and able to serve in public appointments, so that we can change root and branch our institutions, so that they look more like the people that they serve. And here in the UK, we've had the Deputy Prime Minister, we've had front bench MPs, we've had the opposition leader, David Cameron, speaking at our event to inspire the next generation, to create and nurture that next generation that will act as ambassadors that will go out and say, this is how the system works, and that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be a politician or a decision maker. You have to have an investment and a desire to contribute to your local community. And we hope that through our organization and through the election of Obama, and tomorrow the work begins, as Obama has said himself, that we can go out and we can inspire and engage people to realize that they have a stake and that they, as well as Obama, can make a difference.
What kind of impact has the candidacy and now the inauguration of Mr. Obama had on the United Kingdom, especially among the minority youth?
Oh, it's been absolutely huge. I mean, we have a number of people that were at our event who will go on to be black MPs in our Westminster Parliament. We have people that will go on to become ministers. And I predict that here in the UK, in the next 10 or 15 years, we will have our first black mainstream party political leader. In the next 30 years, we will have a black prime minister. Now, if you'd said Obama was going to be the president 2 years ago, people would have laughed you out of town. Now, what we know is barriers are there to be broken, whether it's the man on the moon, whether it's the first female president, which we have some license to, or whether it's having the first female woman from the Conservative Party in Parliament. Barriers are there to be broken. And what we're trying to do is say to people that today is just the beginning.
All right, thanks very much. That's Ashok Viswanathan, and he's the founder of Operation Black Vote. Coming up, the lighter side of Inauguration Day, the Inauguration Parade. Please stay tuned.
Well, the tradition of an inaugural parade dates back to the very first inauguration, when George Washington took the oath of office on April 30th, 1789, in New York City. As he began his journey from Mount Vernon, Virginia, to New York, local militias joined his procession as it passed through various towns along the way. Once he arrived in New York, members of the Continental Army, government officials, members of Congress, and prominent citizens escorted Washington to Federal Hall for his swearing-in ceremony. The first organized parade occurred in 1809 at the inauguration of James Madison. A troop of cavalry escorted him to the Capitol. After taking the oath of office, Madison sat in review of 9 companies of militia. Future inaugurations saw these military escorts grow more and more elaborate. William Henry Harrison's parade in 1841, for example, featured floats. And for the first time, military companies from outside the Washington, D.C. area accompanied the president-elect to the Capitol. Citizens' clubs, political clubs, several military bands, and groups of college students also marched in the parade, setting a precedent.
Following his inaugural address today, President Obama retreated to the Capitol building for the post-inaugural luncheon. That's a tradition that has a long history. After the swearing-in and inaugural address, President Obama was escorted to Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol for the traditional inaugural luncheon, hosted by the Joint Congressional Committee on Inaugural Ceremonies. This tradition dates back as far as 1897. A luncheon was given for President McKinley and several other guests at the U.S. Capitol, but it did not begin in its current form until 1953. Today, the luncheon features cuisine reflecting the home states of the new president and vice president, as well as the theme of the inauguration. There are speeches and toasts to the new administration, as well as gift presentations.
Well, let's go out to the parade route now, where we have our own Chinadu Afor standing by at Freedom Plaza. Chinadu's been out there in the cold now for hours, waiting for the parade to start. What's happening, Chinadu?
Well, Joe, the mood is still the mood here is still festive with expectation as all eyes turn towards the hill for the beginning of the parade. We just had an announcement that the parade will begin in approximately 2 minutes. There are law enforcement agents on both sides of the street, and everybody is just waiting patiently for the parade to start. But it's going to be imminent in a matter of maybe minutes right now.
Chinadu, what was the reaction of the people along the parade route as President Obama gave his inaugural speech?
It was electrifying. People were actually repeating the oath of office along with him. That shows you the measure of support he's getting. There were tears, there were laughter, there was joy, there was screaming. Everybody wanted him to succeed, and they were just hoping that by repeating the oath of office with him and also the invocation and prayer, that it just might, in their own little way, help him succeed and achieve his objective as President of the United States.
Now, of course, many of our listeners know Chinadu for covering the various stories in Nigeria and the political developments there. Chinadu, having seen this inauguration, how would you compare it briefly to an inauguration of a Nigerian president?
It's an elaborate occasion. The inauguration of a Nigerian president usually is not as elaborate. And it's not done outdoors. In most cases, it's just he's sworn in, he takes the oath of office, and then he goes back home. But for one, it's elaborate. A lot of people are involved in this, a lot of activities. The security is intense, but watertight. But of course, the cold, of course, Joe. It's intensely cold here, but people don't mind it. And there appears to be some kind of pride in what is happening. Remember, in Nigeria, the elections are usually contentious. So a lot of people don't come out if their candidates don't win. But here it appears everyone is a winner, everyone is happy, everyone is celebrating, everyone is jubilant, and it's a great thing to see, Joe.
Thank you, Chinadu, and kudos to Chinadu, because even on the even in a warm office, Chinadu usually wears a wool hat, so it must be very cold.
It is really cold, Joe, but I'll be okay. I bet I will be.
Okay.
Well, as we have been mentioning, there's been a lot of international interest, of course, in the inauguration of President Barack Obama. And Richard Wolff, who is a senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, he's been covering Mr. Obama since February of 2007. In a conversation with Anya Zalewski, he reveals who are the foreign leaders President Obama admires most.
I'd like to ask you, who would be the largest influence on him? You know, many people mention President Lincoln as an inspiration, somebody he's looking up to. But is there any foreign leader, perhaps, that he might be particularly admiring?
Yeah, there's no question that he loves Lincoln. Obviously, they both come from Illinois, and he served in Springfield in the state legislature where Lincoln served, too. So those parallels about healing the country are with him. In fact, he just recently took his family to go see the Lincoln Memorial, which is, of course, where Martin Luther King gave his great I Have a Dream speech. International leaders, he has always admired Mahatma Gandhi and had a picture of him up in his Senate office. And one of the first political movements, activities he ever got involved with was the anti-apartheid movement, divestment from South Africa. So I guess you'd have to put Mandela up there with Gandhi.
Okay. And I hope I won't reveal too big of a secret if I mention that you got a deal with Crown Books Publishers to write Mr. Obama's biography.
Yes, it's a campaign book, a campaign book called Renegade, which is...
Can you elaborate on the title?
Yeah, Renegade is Obama's Secret Service code name. So it's what the Secret Service agents call him when they're talking to each other on their radios. And for me, it also captures the sort of rule-breaking spirit of this guy who didn't wait his turn like everyone said he should and really did something quite dramatic that we haven't seen in modern politics, really in living memory. So the book is about the campaign. It's about how he did it and what it says about him. Who is this man and how does he operate? That's really what the book is about, and it comes out in a few months.
All right. We have to invite you to talk about the book in June. For now, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Richard Wolff, Senior White House Correspondent for Newsweek magazine.
You're listening to live coverage of Inauguration 2009 on The Voice of America.
Well, across from the White House, we find our Cole Mallard in place at Lafayette Square. Cole, you're at the location where the parade ends, but it's also where President Obama will get to see all of those performers who followed him to the White House.
Absolutely, Sarah, and believe you me, there's going to be a lot of them. As a matter of fact, there's going to be almost 100 entries altogether, and that includes everything from ceremonial military regiments to citizens groups, marching bands and floats, drum and fife corps. And I thought, even though we are awaiting the actual parade to come by the White House, I'd give you a couple of highlights about what we can expect to see. One of them is Boy Scout Troop 358 of Grace Baptist Church in Germantown, and it's their first appearance in an inaugural parade. And one of the interesting things about this group is it's billed as the oldest African-American Boy Scout troop in the entire nation. Along with them, the Freedom Riders will be coming from Kersey, Colorado, and they are billed as having a rich tradition of honoring the sacrifices of those who serve our country, past and present. And, of course, what inaugural parade would be complete for Barack Obama beside the Hawaiian state float, which celebrates the Aloha state status as the birthplace of President Obama and features a large volcano modeled after the famous Diamond Head volcano near Waikiki Beach. And others briefly that will be making a pass by the White House are the National Air and Space Museum will be represented along with the Pennsylvania state float, and the Special Olympics, along with the Temple Lipizzans of Temple Farms in Illinois. Now, for those of you who don't know that, the Lipizzans are a rather famous brand of horses. They're the home of the famed Lipizzans that are considered to be Europe's oldest breed of domesticated horses. And in addition to that, we'll be seeing the Tuskegee Airmen, something to represent the United States Secret Service, and the Virginia Military Institute Corps of Cadets. Sarah, that's about it for the moment.
Well, I did want to just say that, Cole, I happened to ride the bus near the White House area. It's usually how I commute into work. Mm-hmm. And I noticed just the other day there was a big sign on one of the buildings near Lafayette Square there saying, "Welcome Sasha and Malia," the daughters of yes. President Obama. I think they want to make them feel at home in their new home.
Absolutely. No question about it. And I'm sure they will. And, I mean, they'll be able to come across the street here to Lafayette Park, which is a 7-acre public park, which I think, as I mentioned earlier, was originally part of the White House, Sarah. But then during Thomas Jefferson's administration, he decided that it would be a good idea to cut it in half with Pennsylvania Avenue, and that's how it came to be that way today.
All right, thanks very much. That's Cole Mallard reporting from Lafayette Square.
Well, there are many issues facing President Obama as he takes office, but where is Africa on his list of priorities? Professor David Shin of George Washington University is a former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia. He spoke with me about the importance of sub-Saharan Africa to the Obama administration.
Well, if looked at in isolation, it's very important. However, putting it in the context of all of the other crises around the world today, and not the least of which is our own internal economic crisis, it does not loom very large, the continent as a whole or the individual problems that exist there. But I think the administration will determine relatively early in its administration that the complexity of the issues that do exist in Africa, the Congo, Sudan, Somalia, among others, are going to require it to give a great deal of attention, at least at the second tier level of government, not necessarily at the presidential level. But I think very early on, the second tier is going to have to pay serious attention to these issues.
What do you mean by the second tier?
Basically, from the heads of various departments, the Department of State, the Department of Defense, on down through their deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, some attention is going to have to be paid. But I suspect that the president himself is going to be so wrapped up in other key international issues and the economic crisis that he will have relatively little time, if any, to spend on African issues initially.
Are there veteran officials in place to handle this?
Well, that's an interesting question. Whenever you go through a transition, it's always a difficult period because you normally have placeholders in all of the government departments who are effectively senior career officials because all of the political appointees normally disappear from the previous administration. Of course, this will be a little different this time because Secretary Gates is staying in place at the Defense Department, although those under him, the political appointees under him, may depart. But at the State Department, it will be pretty much of a complete changeover at the top level. And whenever you have that situation, my experience has been that even senior bureaucrats are a little reluctant to make significant policy decisions unless they've been given the go-ahead by the new incoming administration. And that normally doesn't happen. Only after their political appointees have been put in place are you likely to get real policy direction. And that will always take some time because these people have to be approved by the Senate, or at least most of them do.
Do you think African countries might be expecting too much from an Obama administration due to his Kenyan roots?
I think probably that is true. I think there's an enormous enthusiasm for the new president in Africa, and well-deserved. At the same time, the Africans must understand the enormity of the issues that are facing the United States, both domestically and internationally. To some extent, they're going to have to wait in line for attention at the senior-most level.
George Washington University Professor David Shin, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia.
Well, to recap, President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden are still at the U.S. Capitol, where they're enjoying their congressional lunch, a tradition which is put on every 4 years. And once that luncheon ends, the parade, the inaugural parade, to the White House, from the Capitol to the White House, will begin. And there are hundreds of thousands of people have gathered and are waiting for the parade to begin. VOA has a number of reporters stationed along the route, and in the next hour, we will be going to them. Also, I should remind you that in the next hour of this special inauguration show, we will replay Mr. Obama's inaugural address. So please stay tuned for that.
Also, former U.S. President George Bush, who served as the nation's chief executive for 8 years, has left Washington. Mr. Bush and his wife, Laura, departed the nation's capital after witnessing U.S. President Barack Obama take his oath of office. The former president, though, has left a series of pressing problems for his successor. Mr. Bush holds one of the lowest public approval ratings of any outgoing U.S. president. Now, after the swearing-in ceremony, President Obama and the First Lady escorted Mr. and Mrs. Bush to a waiting helicopter, which took them to Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, D.C. Now, also in keeping with a White House tradition, Mr. Bush left a note for Mr. Obama. A spokeswoman said Mr. Bush left the note in the top desk drawer in the Oval Office Monday night, and the spokeswoman said Mr. Bush wished Mr. Obama well, but she declined to give further details.
Well, please stay tuned. I'm Sarah Williams, along with Joe DiCapua. VOA special coverage of this Inauguration Day for President Barack Obama continues in 5 minutes, right after a world news update from VOA News Now.
It's 20 hours Universal Time, and here's the news from the Voice of America. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Gloria Gibson. Barack Obama has taken office as president with a call for Americans to work together to overcome the nation's challenges.
The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness.
More than a million people attended the ceremony, watching from screens set up along the National Mall. The first African-American president said the country faces economic turmoil brought on by greed and collective failure to make hard choices. He said the state of the economy calls for swift, bold action to create new jobs and the foundation for new growth. After witnessing Barack Obama take the oath of office, former President George Bush and his wife Laura left Washington. They flew by helicopter to nearby Andrews Air Force Base. Before leaving for Texas, they participated in a brief departure ceremony. Meanwhile, a single U.S. senator is threatening to delay the expected confirmation of Senator Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State when the Senate convenes later today. Republican Senator John Cornyn says he will not give consent because he is not satisfied with Senator Clinton's responses to questions about her husband's foundation. If he does withhold his consent, a full roll call vote likely will be held on Wednesday. U.S. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is demanding a full investigation into what he calls the outrageous bombing of the UN compound in Gaza. He became the first international leader to visit the Gaza Strip following Israel's 22-day offensive. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez has more on the Secretary General's visit.
The UN chief got a first-hand look at the devastation left by 3 weeks of Israeli air and ground attacks on Hamas targets. He called for Israel and Hamas to stick to the fragile ceasefire they began Sunday and urged them to exercise restraint. Mr. Ban did not meet with Hamas officials. The ceasefire is holding, but there were more signs the dispute between Israel and Hamas is far from settled. In calling it ceasefire, Israel demanded Hamas not fire rockets into its territory and refrain from rearming. Hamas said Israel must pull out all of its troops and open Gaza's borders or face new attacks. Hamas's military infrastructure was severely damaged in the Israeli offensive, but the group appeared to retain some support among Gaza residents. Hundreds of people gathered in Gaza City claiming victory for Hamas and urging international recognition of the Islamist militant group. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Russia and Ukraine have resumed the flow of natural gas to Europe, ending a midwinter standoff that left millions of customers on the continent without heat or power during 13 days of bitter cold. VOA's Peter Fedinsky has the details.
An official at a metering station owned by Russia's Gazprom State Energy Company says the taps were opened at 10:24 a.m., 24 minutes later than scheduled. Officials on both sides of the Russian-Ukrainian border confirm gas is flowing toward Europe. Gazprom and its Ukrainian counterpart, Naftohaz, signed a 10-year contract Monday based on an agreement between the prime ministers of both countries. The previous contract expired on December 31st, prompting Russia to cut off gas to Ukraine on New Year's Day. Both sides blame each other for halting deliveries to Europe on January 7th during an unusually cold winter. Gazprom chairman Alexei Miller says Ukraine will pay market price for gas with a 20% discount through the end of this year. Miller says the base price for the first quarter will be $360 per 1,000 cubic meters. He says that gas prices are pegged to the price of oil, which means Ukraine's future costs will depend on price fluctuations for oil and oil products. Peter Fedinsky, VOA News, Moscow.
South Korea and the European Union say they have made significant progress in negotiations on a free trade agreement. EU Trade Commissioner Catherine Ashton told reporters in Seoul Tuesday that the two sides moved closer to a deal during this week's talks in the South Korean capital. And South African leaders are planning a new summit to try to resolve Zimbabwe's political deadlock after power-sharing talks failed to yield a breakthrough. I'm Gloria Gibson, VOA News. More news on the internet at voanews.com.
And welcome back to VOA's special coverage of the inauguration of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States. I'm Joe DiCapua with Sarah Williams joining me in the studio. In this hour of our special coverage of Inauguration Day 2009, we hear again from President Obama. We will replay Mr. Obama's speech in its entirety, and then we'll ask our political experts for their insight into Mr. Obama's comments. Following the speech and the thoughts from our political team, we'll return to Pennsylvania Avenue for more on the inaugural parade. And we'll learn more about the rest of the festivities for the remainder of this historic day.
First, however, the words of Barack Obama, the speech he delivered shortly after taking the oath of office as the 44th President of the United States. Here now, President Barack Obama.
My fellow citizens, I stand here today humbled by the task before us. Grateful for the trust you have bestowed, mindful of the sacrifices borne by our ancestors. I thank President Bush for his service to our nation. As well as the generosity and cooperation he has shown throughout this transition. 44 Americans have now taken the presidential oath. The words have been spoken during rising tides of prosperity and the still waters of peace. Yet, every so often, the oath is taken amidst gathering clouds and raging storms. At these moments, America has carried on not simply because of the skill or vision of those in high office, but because we, the people, have remained faithful to the ideals of our forebears and true to our founding documents. So it has been, so it must be with this generation of Americans. That we are in the midst of crisis is now well understood. Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age. Homes have been lost, jobs shed, businesses shuttered. Our health care is too costly, our schools fail too many, and each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet. These are the indicators of crisis. Subject to data and statistics. Less measurable, but no less profound, is a sapping of confidence across our land. A nagging fear that America's decline is inevitable, that the next generation must lower its sights. Today, I say to you that the challenges we face are real. They are serious and they are many. They will not be met easily or in a short span of time. But know this, America, they will be met. Yeah.
On this day, we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics. We remain a young nation, but in the words of Scripture, the time has come to set aside childish things. The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness. In reaffirming the greatness of our nation, we understand that greatness is never a given. It must be earned. Our journey has never been one of shortcuts or settling for less. It has not been the path for the faint-hearted, for those who prefer leisure over work or seek only the pleasures of riches and fame. Rather, it has been the risk-takers, the doers, the makers of things, some celebrated, but more often men and women obscure in their labor, who have carried us up the long, rugged path towards prosperity and freedom. For us, they packed up their few worldly possessions and traveled across oceans in search of a new life. For us, they toiled in sweatshops and settled the West, endured the lash of the whip, and plowed the hard earth. For us, they fought and died in places like Concord and Gettysburg, Normandy and Quezon. Time and again, these men and women struggled and sacrificed and worked till their hands were raw so that we might live a better life. They saw America as bigger than the sum of our individual ambitions, greater than all the differences of birth or wealth or faction. This is the journey we continue today. We remain the most prosperous, powerful nation on earth. Our workers are no less productive than when this crisis began. Our minds are no less inventive, our goods and services no less needed than they were last week or last month or last year. Our capacity remains undiminished, but our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed. Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. For everywhere we look, there is work to be done. The state of our economy calls for action, bold and swift, and we will act, not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. We will build the roads and bridges, the electric grids and digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. We will restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its cost. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories. And we will transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age. All this we can do. All this we will do. Now, there are some who question the scale of our ambitions, who suggest that our system cannot tolerate too many big plans. Their memories are short, for they have forgotten what this country has already done, what free men and women can achieve when imagination is joined to common purpose and necessity to courage. What the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted beneath them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works, whether it helps families find jobs at a decent wage, care they can afford, a retirement that is dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, programs will end.
And those of us who manage the public's dollars will be held to account to spend wisely, reform bad habits, and do our business in the light of day, because only then can we restore the vital trust between a people and their government. Nor is the question before us whether the market is a force for good or ill. Its power to generate wealth and expand freedom is unmatched. But this crisis has reminded us that without a watchful eye, the market can spin out of control. The nation cannot prosper long when it favors only the prosperous. The success of our economy has always depended not just on the size of our gross domestic product, but on the reach of our prosperity, on the ability to extend opportunity to every willing heart. Not out of charity, but because it is the surest route to our common good. As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man, a charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake. And so, to all the other peoples and governments who are watching today, from the grandest capitals to the small village where my father was born, know that America is a friend of each nation and every man, woman, and child who seeks a future of peace and dignity, and we are ready to lead once more. Recall that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism not just with missiles and tanks, but with the sturdy alliances and enduring convictions. They understood that our power alone cannot protect us, nor does it entitle us to do as we please. Instead, they knew that our power grows through its prudent use. Our security emanates from the justness of our cause, the force of our example, the tempering qualities of humility and restraint. We are the keepers of this legacy. Guided by these principles once more, we can meet those new threats that demand even greater effort, even greater cooperation and understanding between nations. We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. With old friends and former foes, we will work tirelessly to lessen the nuclear threat and roll back the specter of a warming planet. We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you. For we know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers. We are shaped by every language and culture, drawn from every end of this earth. And because we have tasted the bitter swill of civil war and segregation and emerged from that dark chapter stronger and more united, we cannot help but believe that the old hatreds shall someday pass, that the lines of tribes shall soon dissolve, that as the world grows smaller, our common humanity shall reveal itself, and that America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace. To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward, based on mutual interest and mutual respect. To those leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict or blame their society's ills on the West, know that your people will judge you on what you can build, not what you destroy. To those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, Know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist. To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds. And to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty, we say we can no longer afford indifference to the suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect. For the world has changed, and we must change with it. As we consider the road that unfolds before us, we remember with humble gratitude those brave Americans who, at this very hour, patrol far-off deserts and distant mountains. They have something to tell us, just as the fallen heroes who lie in Arlington whisper through the ages. We honor them not only because they are the guardians of our liberty, but because they embody the spirit of service, a willingness to find meaning in something greater than themselves. And yet, at this moment, a moment that will define a generation, it is precisely this spirit that must inhabit us all. For as much as government can do and must do, it is ultimately the faith and determination of the American people upon which this nation relies. It is the kindness to take in a stranger when the levees break, the selflessness of workers who would rather cut their hours than see a friend lose their job, which sees us through our darkest hours. It is the firefighter's courage to storm a stairway filled with smoke, but also a parent's willingness to nurture a child that finally decides our fate. Our challenges may be new. The instruments with which we meet them may be new. But those values upon which our success depends, honesty and hard work, courage and fair play, tolerance and curiosity, loyalty and patriotism, these things are old. These things are true. They have been the quiet force of progress throughout our history. What is demanded then is a return to these truths. What is required of us now is a new era of responsibility, a recognition on the part of every American that we have duties to ourselves, our nation, and the world, duties that we do not grudgingly accept, but rather seize gladly, firm in the knowledge that there is nothing so satisfying to the spirit, so defining of our character, than giving our all to a difficult task. This is the price and the promise of citizenship. This is the source of our confidence, the knowledge that God calls on us to shape an uncertain destiny. This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath. So let us mark this day with remembrance of who we are and how far we have traveled. In the year of America's birth, in the coldest of months, a small band of patriots huddled by dying campfires on the shores of an icy river. The capital was abandoned. The enemy was advancing. The snow was stained with blood. In a moment when the outcome of our revolution was most in doubt, the father of our nation ordered these words be read to the people. Let it be told to the future world that in the depth of winter, when nothing but hope and virtue could survive, that the city and the country, alarmed at one common danger, came forth to meet it. America, in the face of our common dangers, in this winter of our hardship, let us remember these timeless words. With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
The inaugural address of President Barack Obama, who at this moment is getting into a car along with his wife, and Vice President Biden and his wife, and they're preparing to join in the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue, which will take them from the U.S. Capitol to the Obama's new home, the White House.
Well, joining us now for some final thoughts on the Obama address are VOA national correspondent Jim Malone, political historian Alan Lichtman, and from the White House, correspondent Paula Wolfson. Let me go to Professor Lichtman first. What's your overview of this speech?
My overview of this speech is that it was a somber rather than a stirring address, that it was an historical sermon rather than a rally, that Obama really wanted to address in a very serious way the crisis that faces us at home and, of course, the many crises that face us abroad. It was also a speech, I think, that where you can see the building blocks of past inaugural addresses, very much steeped in history. And I'm not just talking about the most obvious references. I'm talking about more subtle references. For example, Thomas Jefferson, who represented the first transfer of power in America when he took over in 1801, tried to transcend our differences of faction by saying, we are all Federalists. That was the opposition. We are all Republicans, his party. And he talked about that as well. We talked about that the nation is greater than all the differences of birth or wealth or faction. It's built on Lincoln through his references to scripture like Lincoln. And just as Lincoln talked about the better angels of our nature, he talked about choosing a better history. It's built upon Franklin Roosevelt. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt tried to get us to overcome a crisis of confidence, and Obama addressed that as well. It's built upon John Kennedy. Like Kennedy, he warned our enemies that if they try to do us harm, we will defeat them. Like Kennedy, he said, as much as government can do, it's really the faith and determination of the American people that matters. And surprisingly, it's also to some extent built on Ronald Reagan, a conservative president, because Obama says, you know, if programs don't work, programs are going to end. An echo of Ronald Reagan talking about government being the problem, not the solution. So this is a carefully crafted address built upon the great moments of past inaugural addresses, yet at the same time giving us a very somber assessment of where we stand now and expressing his determination to get us to pull together to solve our problems, not overnight, but at least over time.
National correspondent Jim Malone.
I think it's a bit of having the American public look itself in the mirror, too, and realize that Barack Obama is not going to be the messiah on these issues. If we look at the poll numbers, there's a great deal of confidence in his ability to lead. There's a great deal of faith that he'll be able to overcome some of these problems. But obviously, all the problems are daunting taken together between the economy and, of course, the foreign policy challenges, especially in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in the Middle East. So in a sense, Obama's turning the mirror back on the public and saying, look, you have to come to a realization here that we have to work together. He's talking about this new era of responsibility. He wants the public to join with him to sort of tackle these tough problems. He mentioned, for example, on the economy, part of the root cause of all of that was greed. So he's trying to get people to kind of look in the mirror, I think, reflect on where we're at and what we need to do as a country to sort of pull together. And given his record of being able to rally people with rhetoric, I think he feels this is his best approach early in his term, and he's going to have to put this to good use, I think, over the next several weeks as he tries to get Congress to act on the most important early objective of his administration, which is this stimulus plan to sort of spark the economy back into growth.
And White House correspondent Paula Wolfson, your reaction.
Well, you know, Sarah, about 10 days ago or so, the new president, then the president-elect, took his two daughters over to the Lincoln Memorial, and he showed them inscribed on the walls words from President Lincoln's second inaugural address. And the little one, Sasha, who's about 6 or 7, said, "Ooh, that's very long." And president-elect at that point said, "Well, you know, mine may be a little bit longer. For inaugural address, that's really kind of short." Which prompted Malia, who was 10, to say, "First African-American president. Better be good." Well, history will judge just how good it was, but what he did do and what he succeeded in doing, as Jim and Alan have mentioned already, is setting the tone for his administration. Was the lofty, lofty rhetoric perhaps of John Kennedy's inaugural address there? Well, maybe not. But he did set the tone. It was a speech for the times. There was a hint of optimism I heard there when he said, "Yes, we have problems, but we will defeat them." The hope, the optimism. But it was also very pragmatic, very realistic, very upfront about the problems the nations face, that America faces at home and around the world, and about what needs to be done to resolve them. So you get a lot of pragmatism mixed with just enough hope, optimism, and that's the tone for what we're going to see coming out of the White House in the days, weeks, months ahead.
And Jim Malone, we should add there was some rather serious news during this congressional luncheon for President Obama. Veteran U.S. Senator Edward Kennedy, the brother of the late President John F. Kennedy, who has been suffering from brain cancer, he apparently required medical attention during this luncheon and I believe was taken out of the building in an ambulance. That's rather a sad event to happen.
It is, and it's not clear, you know, what the prognosis. Of course, he is battling brain cancer. Some of the witnesses up there said it appeared as though he suffered convulsions, possibly a seizure. I think this was upsetting to a number of his Senate colleagues. In fact, the video we've seen from the television network showed several of his Senate colleagues, both Democrats and Republicans, sort of hovering around him as he was put into an ambulance up at the Capitol. So certainly everyone hopes for the best with Senator Kennedy. And Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia also apparently became ill briefly during the luncheon, and he had to get some medical attention as well. So two of the really old lions of the Democratic Party in the Senate, having some medical challenges here during this, what otherwise would be a very happy occasion, the first luncheon with the new president, Barack Obama.
And even as we speak, there is more news coming in on that. A spokesman for Senator Byrd telling one of their local TV stations in West Virginia that he's okay, he was not taken to a hospital. That being said, a radio pool reporter, that is the reporter who's out there for all the radio networks, including VOA, on the parade route, says that an ambulance has been seen leaving the Senate side of the Capitol under police escort, and apparently that is an ambulance taking Senator Kennedy to a local hospital.
Thank you, Paula. That's White House correspondent Paula Wolfson. We've been joined by national correspondent Jim Malone. And, of course, political historian Alan Lichtman. Let's check out a little bit what happened on the Mall today, which is the area just say off the parade route. And VOA reporter James Buddy was out on the street earlier today and talked with some of the people about the historic day.
Jason.
Jason from where?
Indiana.
Indiana.
Yeah, Manchester College.
Oh, wow. You're a student, eh?
Yeah.
So what brings you here?
Well, we're here with a class with Dr. Williams and to celebrate the 44th president of the United States. Yep.
Were you very active during the election?
Yeah, I actually campaigned out in Iowa for the caucuses for Senator Obama.
What do you think now that he has been elected?
Almost lack of words to explain the situation, really.
Thank you. What are your expectations of him? What would you like for him to do?
Expectations are high, but definitely need to set the economy straight. I'd say this is goal number one.
My name is Arlo Fury.
From where?
I'm from Ghana, West Africa.
Ghana. Yeah, yeah. Ghana just had his own election, is that right?
Yeah, it's incredible. And President John Atamuos is now the current president.
So what do you think about the large crowd?
Well, the crowd is extremely impressive. I'm very much impressed by it. It's like the weather condition is very unfavorable, but people are still willing to be in here to feel the Barack thing. Everybody wants to have a taste of it, and it's quite incredible. It's impressive. I mean,
what do you think should be the relationship between United States and Africa?
Well, Africans are looking up to the new American government, which is going to be led by Barack Obama, a whole lot, because the present state of the American economy has had a rippling effect all across Africa, and people are first of all going to look out for what Obama is going to do to help fix the U.S. economy. Okay. Because once the U.S. economy is up and running, it has a rippling effect, and most African countries would like, you know, for Obama to put in place sound economic policies that will benefit countries all across the world, especially in Africa, which is still a developing continent.
And that was a report from VOA's James Buddy. Well, meanwhile, the inaugural parade is going ahead along Pennsylvania Avenue at this hour. Let's check in one more time with some of our reporters along the parade route. First, Freedom Plaza, where Francis Alonzo is standing by.
Hello, Sarah. As you mentioned, you know, people here are still very buoyant and excited, and the excitement here is contagious. I was listening to James Buddy's piece there, and he mentioned some of the countries, African countries that are represented there in the mall. And, you know, here at Freedom Plaza, you can see all kinds of flags. In particular, I've seen the Ethiopian flag, I've seen the Kenyan flag, as well as the Puerto Rican flag. So, you know, everyone from all over the world has come to see that, and also immigrants, and people are eagerly awaiting to see the parade and to see another glimpse of President Obama come by. The mood here is still excited, still expectant, even though it's gotten really colder, and now the sun seems to be setting behind the buildings, and the wind seems to be picking up and the temperature is dropping. But that has not diminished the people's excitement here.
Well, Francis, there has been a tradition since, I think, the Carter administration, that the new president gets out of his limousine and walks the final distance to the White House. I guess you don't know yet whether that will happen today, but that's certainly a possibility.
Well, you know, and a lot of people here are hoping to see that. Now, there is expectation that he would do that. Of course, now the last person to do that is Jimmy Carter, who actually got out and walked a piece of the parade route. You know, people here are hoping that he'll do that, and hoping he'll do that right here at Freedom Plaza. You know, it would be exciting to see that, especially with his personality. You know, people think that he just might be able to do that, but, you know, security is really tight. And again, the people's hopes are still high to get a personal glimpse of him here.
All right, well, thanks very much. That is Francis Alonzo, who is at Freedom Plaza.
Across from the White House, we find our intrepid Cole Mallard at Lafayette Square, braving the cold. So, Cole, describe the scene there at the reviewing stand where President Obama and his guests will be watching the parade.
Well, I'd be delighted to do that. There really is still not much activity right across from the White House as yet, because the parade hasn't reached us here. But the crowd has thickened, and those stands that I was talking about on the bleachers on the left and right side of the viewing stand are filling up now with dignitaries, VIPs, and others who have come apparently from the Capitol, because we had a whole bunch of buses coming down Pennsylvania Avenue to let them out. In the meantime, though, I thought it would be interesting. I gave a list of some of the participants in the parade earlier, and there's a few more I'd like to point out, especially some of these high school bands, because they are so, these kids have worked hard, and they've done quite a bit in order to be able to come and be a part and be chosen for the inaugural parade. And I thought I'd run down a few of them and show just how many different places they're from around the country. The Adams Central High School Patriot Marching Band is from Hastings, Nebraska. Alexis I. DuPont High School Tiger Marching Band from Wilmington, Delaware. And from Blue Springs, Missouri, we've got the Blue Springs High School Golden Regiment Marching Band. The Brattleboro Union High School Band from Brattleboro, Vermont. And from good old Brooklyn, New York, we got the Brooklyn Steppers Marching Band. And Carl Sandburg High School's Marching Eagles is from Orlando Park, Illinois. I could go on, Joe. I'll give you a few more if you need some.
But these kids are pretty brave, because I've seen them. These marching bands wait on the sidelines for their chance to go down Pennsylvania Avenue, and they wait for hours and hours and hours in the cold. So.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And I can tell you right now, it's plenty cold. I can't remember who said it earlier, but it seems like it's gotten colder rather than warmer as the afternoon has waned on. But nevertheless, like those high school kids, we're all here and excited about the upcoming parade as it will come down here through the White House.
Thank you, Cole Mallard at Lafayette Square.
Well, our reporter Paul Westfeeling, who earlier in the day was at Capitol Hill before and during President Obama's inaugural address, he had a chance to speak to some observers during the area and asked them what they thought of Mr. Obama's speech.
Oh, wow, it was overwhelming. I think that it was a beautiful thing, you know, for all races to come together as one. So I think now finally the United States have been united.
What about the content of his speech about how he plans to tackle some of the problems that we have?
Well, you know, as far as the content of his speech, I think he took his time and he went through it so that the American public would know that it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a process, like it took a process of him getting into office. So we just have to wait, and we have to pray, and we have to hope that everything lines up accordingly.
When I saw it, I got very emotional. I thought it was, I don't know, it just brought tears to my eyes.
What about you?
I think it was good, great.
What'd you like about it?
When he said, that's how all races can come together, no matter what color or how we look or what our religion is.
Oh, well, it was fabulous. He's a real inspiration. A little bit more on war than I thought he was going to talk about and terrorism, but...
I came all the way from Maine to be here in the center of the universe. This was the most exciting moment of my life.
How are you going to remember this in 10 years, 5 years?
I can't stop. Just the sheer magnitude of this, the good feelings that... You know, everybody in the crowd was just so friendly and warm and sweet and dying to be here.
And one thing I did not notice, that there were any protesters out.
No. And they were talking about last time, the Bush administration, it was just total chaos down here because there were protesters and not all that many people, and it was just chaotic. But this was just... happy chaos.
That's good.
I thought it was a speech that covered a wide range of issues and concerns. America's standing in the world, our responsibility not only to everything that's going on here in terms of the country's needs, but also we've got to be concerned about our position in the world. But certainly it's about taking care of home and making home the kind of place it's supposed to be here in the United States so that all citizens could benefit. So I don't think it shook the earth. Yeah. But I think he did all the right point makings, and this being through with childish things was probably the key point, that it is time to put the partisanship and the bickering and the game playing. Common American is tired of game playing and tired of politics. He wants to see real action and things move for the better.
Yeah, I was very pleased with the speech, having daughters in college and understanding. I hope they understand what took place today and the meaning behind his speech and everything that he said.
Why don't I ask your daughter?
Very good. My name is Angelique Montgomery, also from Chicago. And
did you understand the significance of the day?
I believe so. I think it's just the beginning of what's to come. It's still a lot of work to do for everybody, not just him. College students, the world.
Those were some comments and reactions by observers of the inauguration, and those were gathered by VOA reporter Paul Westfeeling.
Of course, we've sent many reporters out in the cold to give you the details on what's happening today, but we also have special coverage going on indoors. My South African friend, Darren Taylor, has kept warm all day in a pub on Washington's U Street. And from there, Darren gives us the latest on the inauguration. Darren.
Well, Joe, I assure you, I'm everything but stiff at the moment. If you can't loosen up here in U Street, I'm afraid that you cannot loosen up anywhere in this world. I haven't spent the day in just one pub, I must admit. I've hopped into several, gauging people's opinions, speaking to various people from all walks of life on this historic day. So far, undoubtedly, the biggest cheer of the day was reserved for the point in Barack Obama's speech when he said that America does not have to sacrifice its ideals in order to be safe. Now, this U Street area is, of course, home to many African Americans, but also today, really, people from all over the world, eager to celebrate what they are calling a new dawn for the U.S., have packed this area, and they're also eager to shout about Obama embodying the same ideals that Martin Luther King once represented. And in that respect, from what I've seen today, there's been a palpable sense of hope amongst people here. It's emblazoned on their T-shirts, shining in their eyes. It's in the clink of their glasses as they've drank toast upon Mr. Obama and also the hope that he and his incoming administration will herald a day when America rises once again to reclaim what many have told me is its rightful moral standing in the world after what many regard as a truly dark period in U.S. history. In fact, it would be amiss of me here not to mention that here in the U Street corridor, this day has definitely been, from what I've seen, as much a joyous outpouring at the ascension of Barack Obama as it's been a celebration of the exit of George W. Bush. I will not repeat some of the anti-Bush sentiments expressed by people here. Let's just say they're not very radio-friendly. But as much as it's been a party all day here, there have also been quite a few pragmatists that I've bumped into, people that are quite clearly thinking further than the rims of their beer mugs, and quite past the drum-beating patriotism of the occasion. And they're questioning, can Barack Obama do it? Just a few minutes after the speech, a lot of people I spoke to said, we wonder, there are so many different issues and serious issues confronting Obama, and they're wondering, really, can he do it? And they're really questioning, and they're saying, Obama, you've promised us change, and we want it now. Please deliver.
Thank you. Darren Taylor, reporting from a pub in the U Street corridor in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Darren.
Well, later today, after the parade is over and the sun is set on this inauguration day, the celebrations won't be coming to an end because many inaugural balls and galas will take place at venues throughout the Washington, D.C. area, including 10 official balls planned by the Presidential Inaugural Committee and the only ones that the Obamas and Bidens are guaranteed to attend. Among promises to be among the biggest galas will be held at the magnificent Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in Prince George's County in the Washington suburbs. More on the event from Akwe Thompson.
The event is called the African and International Friends Inaugural Ball, the ancestors' dream realized. Karen Bryant is the event planner.
It's clear to the world the significance of having the first African-American president. And for us in Prince George's County, we have gone from being slaves under the ship to the highest office in the world as an African-American president.
The ball promises to be the best and most well-attended in the country. The organizers are the Fallen Soldiers Incorporated, run by Reverend Walter Fauntroy, and the Prince George's Presidential Inaugural Committee, under the leadership of Jack Johnson and several people who were instrumental in Obama's election campaign. Ms. Bryan said the idea of holding the event in Prince George's County was to give the average person a chance to attend this once-in-a-lifetime event. And so preparations are being made for a whopping 17,000 people. Invited dignitaries include, of course, the new president and his wife and several heads of state from around the world and Africa. An event of this size takes a lot of time and planning, and Karen Bryan said she couldn't resist the opportunity to plan it.
I've been involved for about 7 weeks, and I think my average night of sleep is about 4.5 hours.
Tickets for the ball range from $250 to $1,000. Quite a lot of money in these hard economic times. So what should the guests expect, apart from the fact that they are attending such an historic event?
Our entertainment includes Patti LaBelle, Raheem Devon, the OJs, Pieces of a Dream, so many. We have Kenyan African dancers. We have salsa band. We just have international talent, so you will experience that.
The main event in the 50,000-square-foot Potomac Ballroom will include a full dinner and the main stage entertainment. The color theme is red, white, and blue, and the kente cloth. Of course, this is a black tie event, and guests will be looking their elegant best. For VOA News, I'm Akwe Thompson.
Okay, we're going to go now to our presidential historian, Alan Lichtman, as we draw to a close in our coverage, just a few minutes left. Now, the celebrations sure continue tonight, but there's that famous 100 days in office that everyone looks at to see what is accomplished in the first 100 days. What is your view?
Well, of course, the 100 days are based on Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days in the depths of the Great Depression when he pushed 15 major bills through the Congress. Barack Obama is obviously not going to do that, but there are certain lessons that he can take from Franklin Roosevelt's experience that I think will hold him in good stead as he goes from the rhetoric of the presidency to the hard work of governing. Number one, indeed, strike early. Your best chance of getting something done is at the beginning of your administration, before the special interests get their hooks into the administration and Congress, and while you still have this tumultuous public support. Second, bring the people with you. Congress is like Wall Street. It operates on fear and greed. And if the people are with you, like they were with Franklin Roosevelt, Congress is likely to go along. Roosevelt used the technology of his time, the radio, with his fireside chats. Obama has proven to be a master of modern technology, the internet, YouTube, text messages. Use it. Number three, as Franklin Roosevelt said, we need big, bold, persistent experimentation. As Obama said in his address, government can't do it all, but we do need a new direction and major government programs. We have to figure out what works and what doesn't work and think big. Finally, don't try to govern from the middle. It doesn't mean you need to have rancorous partisanship. Obama's shown that he's not that kind of president, but it doesn't mean you necessarily move to the middle. All the great presidents, like Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, they moved the middle to them and changed the conversation about politics and introduced new political eras. Those are the great lessons that I think Barack Obama can take from Roosevelt and that will get his administration off to a really running start.
Now, the fireside chats that President Roosevelt gave to reassure the American people, how often did he give those, and do they serve as an example for Barack Obama? Should he regularly address the American people as to the economic situation?
Well, he didn't overdo the fireside chats. You know, he did those very sparingly on very important matters. And Obama shouldn't overdo, obviously, directly communicating with the nation, either save it for when it counts. But what Franklin Roosevelt did do was hold twice weekly press conferences. You know, in this day and age when, you know, press conferences are as rare as a waning gibbous on the moon, I think Obama could be well advised to keep an open administration, keep in constant contact with the press and with the American people, but save, you know, the big stuff for when you need it for that critical push on legislation or on a critical international matter.
Thank you. That's presidential historian Alan Lichtman. Thank you very much for all your analysis today.
My great pleasure. Great to be here.
Absolutely. Well, meanwhile, the inaugural parade continues. At the moment, the Obamas and the Bidens are participating in the motorcade. They're going down Pennsylvania Avenue. And we've seen a number of bands marching by. And I don't know if we've seen any horses quite yet, but they're certainly the parade is well underway, including their number of spectators that are running along to try to keep up with the motorcade, I believe, probably to keep close to the car carrying the Obamas. In case, as Francis Alonso mentioned a bit earlier, the Obamas decide to get out of the car and perhaps walk to the White House, which in past presidents have done that. Usually they wait till they get fairly near to the White House, kind of around where Francis is at Freedom Plaza. But the moment, the Obamas are still in the car, and I don't think we've got terribly good sound there. But anyway, but meanwhile, We should say, speaking of the balls that go on later on, we have one more perspective on balls, and that is people will wonder. Of course, they were wondering what Michelle Obama would be wearing today during the day.
And I know I was.
Yes, I'm sure you were. She was wearing, or is still wearing, a yellow outfit. But of course, there'll be a lot of speculation and interest in her evening gown that she will be wearing to the inaugural balls later tonight. Now, the gown that she wears to that may very well end up in a museum, literally. The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History has just reopened after a major refurbishing, and one of the new exhibits focuses on the nation's first ladies and their gowns. VOA Susan Yockey asked curator Lisa Kathleen Grady how many gowns the museum has obtained.
We have approximately 80 dresses in the collection, and about 21 of them are inaugural gowns.
What are some of the oldest?
The oldest gown in our collection belonged to Martha Washington. And it's a beautiful, very interesting piece. It's a painted silk. And it's painted in a design of a sort of a ribbon kind of a medallion design. But then it has little hand-painted insects. They're not prettified insects. They really almost look like life sketches of bugs. And it's actually very pretty. You'd think that it wouldn't be, but it's actually a very pretty dress.
What's another unusual one?
We have a dress that's embroidered with a straw, a technique called straw embroidery. And that belongs to the daughter of President Monroe, who served as his hostess at varying points in time. Her mother had slightly ill health. The oldest inaugural gown in the collection actually belonged to Emily Donaldson, who was the niece of Andrew Jackson, whose wife had died before he came into office, and who served as his hostess. It's a sort of a creamy dress with a lace bodice and a lace trim and a long pink ribbon down the front of it. It's a very young-looking gown.
Well, do you think you'll get Ms. Obama's dress?
Well, we certainly hope so. As is tradition for the Smithsonian, the secretary of the Smithsonian will send out a letter in his name to Mrs. Obama after the inauguration, and explain that we have this collection here that is extremely popular and so far has documented all of these first ladies. And would she be so kind as to donate something to represent herself in the collection? That can be anything she chooses. But there'll be a reminder in the letter that it's become traditional and is very popular, a lot of public interest in her inaugural gown.
And that is Lisa Kathleen Grady. She is the curator of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, of that exhibit that features the gowns, displaying the gowns of former first ladies, which I think is one of the most visited sites here in Washington.
I know, a lot of interest. I go there all the time.
I'm sure you do, but no, there is a lot of interest in that.
I guess the next biggest story, which we won't be able to cover, will be how this 1 to 2 million people, how they get home. Because as Sarah and I guess both got here very, very early this morning, and the subways, the train, underground trains were jammed. This is going to be an interesting trek home.
It will be interesting, but I'm hoping that people will sort of leave in different waves. They won't, you know, in the morning, everyone was sort of coming here early, really early, because the authorities were telling people to get here early to be on the mall, you know, really by 7 o'clock, 6 a.m. But hopefully this afternoon, you know, the parade is still ongoing, and perhaps some of the spectators would like to join Darren Taylor in that pub on U Street, or maybe some of the other restaurants around the area. And I believe actually here in the district, because of the celebrations, they have extended hours at some of the bars and restaurants.
Is that what you're recommending, Sarah?
Well, I've just heard that.
Okay. Should we, I think it might be time to thank some of the folks that help put together this show. I mean, you hear our voices, but there are a ton of people that you don't see or hear that really put this show together. You want to start off?
Yes, absolutely. Our directors were Rod Thomas and Bill Werkinger.
And we have studio producers Felicia Butler and Nikki Nicole Lindsay.
Telecommunications manager Bill Keaton.
Field technicians John Croft and Gary Jaffe. And I have the studio text.
Okay, you
You're
better
ready?
Read that.
Rob Mac McLean, Keith Happy Man Holmes, Audrius the King Regis, and Greg Fireman Burns.
And okay. Music by Ed Gursky.
We also have producers Aaron Brummett, Susan Yackey, Judith Latham, Carol Castiel, and
Anya Zalewski.
There you go.
Our editors were Steve Norman, Ashanafi Abeje, and Bill Eagle.
The executive producer of this inauguration special was Mr. Terry Wing.
And the chief of English radio is Sonia Lawrence Green.
So Sarah and I want to thank all of you for tuning in today. We get to do this every 4 years, so it is a special occasion for us.
Every inauguration is a bit different.
It is.
They're never the same.
It is. I don't remember many of the things that just the security measures alone were not in place 4 years ago when we did this.
Absolutely.
It's a totally different atmosphere in Washington just to see so many people come to town and wish the new president well.
All right. Well, from the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Sarah Williams, along with Joe DeCapua. Thanks very much for joining us.